this human or robot thing is actually not just going to happen, but it's going to happen in a scale, at a scale that's going to break some brains.
If I'm Tesla and I'm doing Optimus, I want geographical redundancy from my AI chips. It's unbelievable what will be replaced in terms of human labor. It's already off the charts.
As an executive, you have to delete your brain and start fresh.
There's only a handful of companies on Earth right now that are led by people who are competent engineering first leadership, that most of the rest of these companies are led by finance people.
Tesla's next product is their new way of manufacturing. And it's a big deal.
I feel like for me, V13 is such a gigantic catalyst because it opens the door to everything.
My background is I did play a pretty big role in like how the modern smartphone is made, and led the original team. So when you hear me talk about supply chain, I'm actually from more of the technical side of supply chain in terms of like the processes involved to make the components, what things go together, where do they go together, how do they go together, how do you make, you know, what does the supply chain really look like, and what are the processes to make the products? That's kind of my background. I did that even at an executive level as well, hands-on. So,
yeah. So super well-versed in the space. Okay, so the one thing you said about human or robot manufacturing and supply chain setup, you said that it seems like there will be some parallels or some similarities and commonalities to what you saw from the smartphone side, which you are extremely familiar with. So does that mean, for a dummy like me, what does that mean? That means a shit ton of bots through not that much factory space. Is that a fair characterization of that?
Yeah, I think when you think about factory design, you think about maximizing output per square meter. You think about automation trade-off, payoff, and you think about all of those things. And yeah, I think it's going to be more if you think of the packaging density of building a humanoid bot and what's going to be on the kind of in the chest and in the head. You think of the optics involved. You think of power management. You think of you think of all that in terms of like the packaging density. Yeah, I think it's going to be a little bit more closely to a scale up from a smartphone tablet relative to anything else.
Okay. And do you think, you know, like if I tie it to Tesla specifically, do you think the recent developments around like how the stock is behaving, how people are following the company, Wall Street's sort of lens that they're viewing the Tesla story through, do you think any of that is starting to become like at least whispered? Like are people waking up to the fact that this human or robot thing is actually not just going to happen, but it's going to happen in a scale, at a scale that's going to break some brains? Or do you think we're way too early on that arc?
I don't think we're too early on the arc. I think it all depends on your time horizon as an investor and the kind of things you pick up on. I think it's too early for Wall Street. I think it's too early for spreadsheets. It's just the way that they work. The starting line is like everything that's within 90 days and then kind of like looking out a year. And if you look out a year, you know, this thing's going to be prototyped in larger quantities, you know, in a year. And we're going to see a lot more. There's going to be a lot more, I think, discovery in terms of capability. I've been very impressed with the recent videos in the last 2 weeks. And to me, it's kind of mentally closed a gap in my mind in terms of like, will this really work in a factory? Like, will those fine motor skills actually be able to accurately grab parts? And not only, because when you're in a factory and you're rolling out automation, you're fighting accuracy and speed, and you want them both to work together because you need to yield the maximum amount of part. That's what you're trying to do with a cell or a station in a factory. You want to maximize the yield output and you want to minimize the process time. And I even had questions in my mind. I'm like, is this hand really going to have the proper motor skills? And again, you've got to get accuracy and speed working together, because not only do you want to replace, well, you want to get it to the point where you, I was concerned it was going to be slower than a human. Like, okay, well, then I'm going to need more bots. If it's slower than a human, this thing's going to get expensive. And then all of a sudden, I'm going to have a space problem where in a cell, I could have fit one human before. I need two of these things. So it's starting to close that gap for me, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Got it. Okay. What, yeah, because when I think about the human or robot aspect, like just the TAM for this technology, if it actually works, is we don't even have to talk about how large it is. It's basically anything that's physical human labor, right? So it comes down to more.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk to me about that, because you put something out there. So, yeah. Okay. Help me wrap my head around that.
It's more. I believe it's more. And it, first off, the models are like already kind of nutty, and I'm not being critical. I'm like, they're huge. I mean, it's unbelievable what will be replaced in terms of human labor. It's already off the charts. But when you get back to that speed and accuracy conversation, and then you look at, I think everybody's been kind of like focused on, all right, people coming, labor, we have this many thousand people, I'm going to need less people, right? Well, now all of a sudden you have to start looking at the fixed CapEx that's in the factory, and all those FANUC robot arms. You look at some specialized smaller robotic arms and cells and various cells and operations, and you're like, when I do an automation trade-off decision, I'm looking at this thing as like, okay, it's going to be on this line for this product and this form factor and doing this amount of work. If the humanoid gets fast enough and it gets accurate enough, it may be able to replace the work that existing CapEx was doing, not a human, but existing fixed CapEx was on the line. So not only do you replace the CapEx on the line, but you have a humanoid that's more fungible and that could be retrained and moved elsewhere in the factory. So it completely changes factory design. It completely changes the common serial nomenclature of like what a manufacturing line could look like. I'm not saying you can't have that kind of line. I'm just saying it changes it. And to me, this all fits together because unboxed, the cellular kind of approach, non-serialized approach to unboxed is kind of a bridge to what an Optimus manufacturing model could actually enable. If that makes sense.
Interesting. Hans, go for it. I see you're off mute.
I'm really curious in the way that you are thinking about how that changes the capital requirements of a business up front and the, I guess you would call it resilience. That's one of the hard things about manufacturing at scale today is that the barrier to entry based on the complexity of the equipment that you have to buy, the complexity of everything that you have to plan around that equipment. And then even, this echoes in a fractal way through the supply chain, because if you've got, these machines that you spent $1 billion on, like you have to organize your entire company around feeding that beast and keeping its uptime high and its yield high and all that stuff. Whereas if we move to an economy that is centered around an intelligent, flexible piece of automation that has the ability to do, like you said, is fungible and it can do one thing one day and a different thing a different day, like, what is the impact on the business that's organized around that as the central doer of functional work in the company versus one that's got this massive fixed automation that we have today?
It's a great question. You change the barrier to entry on needing this mountain of CapEx. You change the time to peak volume and the time to break even on that CapEx, which is a really important thing to think about, because now you're going to have this fleet of humanoids that are more fungible than the fixed CapEx that's bolted into the line. By the way, I'm not saying fixed, I'm not saying these huge robotic arms, the things that are moving the entire chassis. I'm not saying everything's going away and it's all humanoids. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is it's not just Optimus is not just replacing the human labor that's on lines today. It's going to actually replace a lot of smaller automated and even medium-sized automated operations. And it may change the whole construct and layout of a line. And then, yes, it changes the equation on utilization. Factory utilization is what you're optimizing for. You're trying to figure out, I bought all this CapEx, how do I get at least, you know, greater than 80% utilization on this? So the fixed cost of those assets are divided across a larger pool of units. And when you do that, that's a line in unit economics. That's one of the lines that adds up to the total COGS to build a product. And if you can divide that over a much larger population of units, you take your fixed CapEx down. That's exactly what Tesla is doing with these interim vehicles, by the way. The interim vehicles going into production, it's going to be stealing the appreciated CapEx from the 3 and Y for the larger CapEx lines. And so they're going to get the volume.
In case they're not familiar. Yeah. So these are the more affordable cars that Tesla has called out in the last couple quarterly earnings report that they're slated to launch in the first half of next year. Go ahead. Didn't mean to.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No, I think that's it. It changes the utilization equation. It changes the time to peak volume, the time to peak margin equation. These are all the things that you're battling when you set out to design a factory. You want to figure out how do you get your cost to design and facilitize that factory. You want to get it out of the product cost as soon as possible. So you want to get the peak utilization quick. You want to get the peak yield quick. You want to minimize your process time as quickly as possible. You want to remove you want that to go to zero as quickly as possible. And the humanoid angle in this is going to enable that, I believe, to be more fungible, move quicker. You're not going to have these fixed lines. That's the other thing. Think about BYD. BYD gets to its 2 million plus EVs with there's literally 35 different models. I don't think people realize it. They have the models for consumers. They have then all the delivery vans and things that they do, but they spread that volume over 35 models. And Tesla is roughly the same EV volume spread over major models. I'm not even talking about the spins. There's five major models from Tesla deliver that volume, BYD 35. Think about the number of lines that change over. Guess what? As a consumer, as an OEM, you don't get any value for a line changeover. When you do a line changeover, that's just completely wasted time, completely wasted space. So there's so many different examples in the cost equation to build a product. I think humanoids are really going to change the model on this, on the fungibility of that. It's just going to bring costs simply lower. And it's not just the classic human labor thing. It's many other lines.
So this is such a interesting discussion, because this is what's going to be at the top of mind, I feel, for a lot of executives that oversee manufacturing, right? The question is going to become, how sure are we that implementing this technology, let's say, will actually get us what we're looking for, which is exactly this. But what I'm also hearing is, if you really want to get the long-term benefits of what it means to have a human or robot, you have to completely rethink how you manufacture from the ground up. You have to get rid of preconceived notions. You have to get rid of decades of MBA or manufacturing, you know, whatever, just like teachings that have been put on the public on how to set up a manufacturing line, how to properly spread out your costs, so on and so forth. When you bring in a fully fungible, meaning like a robot that you can literally put anywhere at any time, and it can do any job you want it to, and it can potentially, I don't know, there's just so many things open up, right? As an executive, you have to delete your brain and start fresh. And so what I'm hearing is, companies that are able to adopt that early on and really embrace that will have a very big advantage long term. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. And I think the humanoid companies that already build products today are the ones that are going to be able to have the highest assurity to get to market. The ones that don't build product today have a lower probability of getting to market, and they have a lower probability of getting their product fit for purpose, for wide purpose, if that makes sense. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying it can't be done. It's just a lower probability. And finally, the third point I'd add to it is the amount of vertical integration involved in building one of these. I'm not just talking about the supply chain. I'm talking about how it's engineered all the way down to the base layer of silicon. If you're trying to make all this work together, you really want your desire would be to have all those teams under one roof, because then you're just, everybody's under the same priorities. Everybody knows it's got to get to a cost structure of X. It's got to get to a scalability of Y. It's got to get to a performance level of Z, and everybody's on the same page. As soon as you start chopping that up and saying, all right, you're the silicon company. Okay. You're the layer one software company. Okay. You're going to be doing the AI inference software for me. Okay. You're going to be doing the integration and manufacturing. As soon as you start chopping that up, you get disparate priorities, and you also are chopping up margins. Everybody in that equation is going to want a piece of margin. So when I look at humanoid bot companies, it's a long list of companies doing them, but it's a very small list of companies that have that capability under one roof.
So it's like, it's, again, it kind of goes back to, if we use the smartphone example loosely, is your Apple has figured out how to sort of marry hardware and software, whereas your Samsung's kind of like putting, like kind of separating those two and trying to have less of a control over each specific piece, where Apple has some control in how to marry those things together. And then now Apple has all the profit while everybody else doesn't. Do you think that's a fair parallel?
Not quite. I think this could be a whole show within itself, especially given my background. Actually, Samsung is more vertically integrated than anybody in the mobile phone world. They make their own memory. They make their own displays. They actually make their own, they have their own modem. They use Qualcomm in various geographies, but they actually have an Exynos modem. They make their own modem. It's like unbelievable. Samsung is unbelievably vertically integrated, and they have internal manufacturing. They also use contract manufacturing, but they have internal manufacturing. So they're highly vertically integrated. Next after that would actually be Huawei. In terms of vertical integration, and Xiaomi, they're vertically, and they have their own internal manufacturing. Apple is 100% contract manufacturing, outside of some small manufacturing that they have for final assembly, like in Ireland and one other place. They're all contract manufacturing, but they do a great job of pulling all those partners together and working through it. Of course, they do their own silicon, but in terms of vertical integration, and Samsung is pretty high profit margins, actually. Okay. But I mean, Apple is also, to your point, they're way up there. But they're actually the Tesla equation right now in vertical integration is actually, if you think about the FSD stack, it's unmatched, and the humanoid stack, it's unmatched anywhere. It doesn't mean that Tesla doesn't go and work with partners. I think they're going to work with partners on the actuator side, for example, but they pretty much have the whole capability end to end. And if they're not doing the part, they're not really necessarily buying something off the shelf. They're co-engineering and really dictating how that part's going to be made with that supplier.
Got it. That's very helpful. Go ahead, Hans.
So when you think about the supply chain for humanoid robots that has yet to be built, and arguably, you know, if Tesla can avoid having to do everything in-house for a product that they would like to sell in the millions of units, potentially billions of units per year at some, you know, distant point in the future, like, how does that shake out? What parts do they make in-house? What parts do they farm out? And who are the likely partners that they would actually work with in order to flesh that supply chain out, that are fast enough, responsive enough, capable enough, flexible enough to actually partner with Tesla on a product of that magnitude?
Yeah, it really starts at the top. And this is what the unique thing about Tesla is, you have somebody at the top of the company that's very technical, that sets those high level, you know, three or four high level targets for the product, and everybody marches in that one direction. But the way companies think about, do they make the part or do they buy it? There is a process behind that. Each company kind of tailors their own kind of, it's called a make versus buy process. And each company kind of tailors that to like their needs and kind of their roadmap. But in general, you're looking at intellectual property. You're looking at security. You're looking at security of supply. You're looking at redundancy of supply. You're looking at competitive cost structure. You're looking at your own capability. You're looking at a number of different things, And what you're trying to figure out is, are you advantaged in some way? Or is there some sort of line you really don't want to cross? Is maybe it's related to intellectual property, or maybe it's, you know, related to just integration into your product. There's a, you basically put it through a series of tests, but you also kind of fall back on like what your company strategy is. And to me, it feels like Tesla's strategy is it starts internal, because you want the lowest network latency for your supply chain. You want from the time you kick that part off to the time it's at its final point for integration, you want that time to be minimized as much as possible. That's all money. That's all cash. And it's what people think the cogs of a product are like, how much did you negotiate, you know, the price with a supplier? That cost is just one term. When you start thinking about inventory terms, you start thinking about quality indemnification, you start thinking about all these wonky things. What burst inventory level do you want them to control? What are the different terms on excess? And all of a sudden you realize the cost equation for how much you pay for a component is much more than just settling on that purchase price. So yeah, companies make decisions that they have their own core strategy. They develop their own make versus buy process. And I think tooling up the humanoid robot supply chain is where a lot of the angst is right now. Basically, it's what are my capabilities? What's the capability in the supply chain? Can I trust these suppliers? Are they global already, or can they be globalized? Because they're going to want to make humanoids in every region. You don't want to it's such a waste to be putting these things in these gigantic boxes, putting them on planes, putting them on freight. You want to be able to build these things geographically. So that those are all the things you're thinking about of like, am I going to do this or am I going to farm it out?
So
go ahead.
If you're Elon Musk and you're thinking through this decision specifically as it relates to the geopolitical tension between the United States and China, and then Elon's personal relationship with Xi, what's the calculus on do I or do I not produce Optimus robots in China versus somewhere else in Asia?
Yeah, you would follow your manufacturing strategy you have for auto for that decision. So if you're going to make a different decision on that, you're probably going to be in the course of making a different decision on auto. So this conversation is actually happening now. There was a reported conversation with Elon and CC Wei from TSMC. And, you know, right now it's kind of, you know, AI5, that chip, it looks like it's going to Samsung for fab. People don't realize like Samsung is a gigantic fab business for silicon, all the way down to like 3 and 4 nanometer. So Samsung has this award. It looks like it's possible that it may be dual sourced to TSMC as well. And for that new Arizona fab coming up, probably for the 26 and 27 timeframe, that if I'm Tesla and I'm doing Optimus, I want geographical redundancy for my AI chips. I want supplier redundancy for my AI chips. I want multiple fabs, multiple geographies. I want my source of supply to be as close to my factory as possible. Those are the rules.
And then, so what percentage? So if you look at the humanoid robot and you try to figure out, okay, how much of the technologies I can tap an existing sort of supply chain and with some modifications versus having brand new things needing to be developed, right? How do you view this product versus like I don't know, a car? Is it like, walk me through how many new things need to be brought into the supply chain for this thing to actually work?
Yeah, I think if you think about a smartphone, for example, there's about, you know, depending on the complexity of the product, 1500 to 1800 parts inside of a smartphone. And about 600 of those or so may be unique to the, like a new custom part for that thing in the industry. And you think of a car is closer to the 10,000, component count range. I think the bots are going to be somewhere, you know, closer to the smartphone tablet range, maybe, you know, a couple of thousand parts inside of them. And I, so I think it's going to be closer to that level of complexity. So Tesla is actually, well, I should say Tesla, Elon's companies, they've got the right now in terms of like printed circuit board manufacturing, the biggest operation in the country right now. It's believed to be for Starlink production in Texas. And so there's a lot of things that are actually coming together where Tesla may be able to do more of this product. I think they may start building their own AI computers, you know, not only the, you know, getting the silicon, they're gonna get the silicon in from TSMC and Samsung, but it, you know, I think that that computer is actually farmed out. They may bring that in, we'll see. But yeah, I think for humanoid, you do not want to be bottlenecked because this is going to scale at levels, you know, you think of cars, they're in the like the single digit millions per year. And Tesla has the highest volume car right now model that's in production. And then now they're going to go to another, they're going to go to the Cybercab, which is going to be the entire volume of their current fleet. So you already have that scale up. And with humanoids, it's just going to be on a completely different level. So you're really focused on multi-sourcing geographically, geographical redundancy, and you're focused on, honestly, you want as much of the capability as possible under your roof, because I think from a security perspective, and I think from just a network latency perspective and not, you know, having the wrong stuff at the wrong places. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing to think about. I think it's going to be closer again to the scale up of a smartphone tablet, but with the added mechanical complexity. That is the thing. The mechanical complexity is going to be through the roof. Now, in your smartphone today, there's a fair amount of mechanical complexity in that chassis, but that chassis, you know, whether it's a stainless frame or it's some form of titanium, some form of, most of them are aluminum in the world. That development has occurred over a number of years. It's been refined. It's been kind of worked through. Everybody still comes out and does some minor modification. But when you look at your smartphone today, it's still kind of this rectangular block. It's somewhere between 7 millimeters and 10 millimeters in total thickness. It hasn't changed much. I think I'm rambling.
No, you're good. You're good. Go ahead, Hans.
I just wanted to drop a tidbit too. When you mentioned the, Starlink factory that Steve Jurvetson, who was one of the early board members of Tesla and who has been a huge advocate of Elon Musk's for a long time, he toured that, and he has been in a number of fabs, has been, you know, directly involved with the fab business for decades. He said that the Starlink factory was the closest thing he had ever seen in his life to an alien dreadnought. And that was including any fab business that he had ever been inside of.
Yeah. Yeah. This can be a whole show. There's so little of that front end of the manufacturing process in terms of like bringing in those 1,000 components and populating them on the PCB, doing that in circuit level testing or functional level testing. There's so little of that actually happens in the US. And there's really no reason why. The only reason why is because the assembly side of manufacturing moved out to Asia with globalization. So why wouldn't you put the front end side of it with it? That's what happened. But there's no reason. Like once you buy that equipment anywhere in the world and you depreciate it over some large volume of manufacturing, plugging that thing in and turning it on and running, doing surface mount manufacturing in the US versus China, there's very little labor involved. There's high levels of automated optical inspection involved, X-ray optical inspection to make sure everything's done the right way. It's a highly automated process. The only reason why there's not a lot more of that in the US is because the assembly side went out in the late 90s for all the consumer electronics into Asia. And so the front end side of it just built up out there.
Got it. So there's like this economic like pool that says like, why do it in the US when you can do it overseas? So that like automatically removes the incentive to. So like if that didn't exist, the more companies would end up where Starlink is at, basically.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's honestly no reason.
It's not an engineering challenge. It's just like, it's like you have the economic incentive is, it's the wrong incentive. That level.
What happened, Farzad, is the assembly side of it became an economic challenge because people looked at the $2 plus labor rates in Asia and said, well, I can't, I can't be, instead of like, you could, I mean, you can get really close on a lot of these products through re-engineering of it, through figuring out what you automate, what you don't automate, figuring out what you platform versus what you change every year. And that's, by the way, that's one of the reasons you see your iPhone and your Samsung looking the same way for 2 or 3 years in a row. That's not out of like pure, like what laziness. They're trying to get more capital efficiency out of their purchases than they've ever before. And quite frankly, all their really up revving is doing minor bumps in the silicon. So, but anyway, that's why they're doing that. But again, this could be a whole other show. We actually built this in Motorola and Google. We actually built a smartphone factory in Texas, a brownfield factory. We gutted it. We built it from the ground up, 5 million unit a year capacity, expandable to 10 million. I led the project. And when we looked at the economics of it, I'm not going to like get like too in the gory details, but you could get it. Like if you really worked and we had more and more revs on it, we ran it for a couple of years. We could have ran it a lot longer. You can get a lot closer than people think. There's no reason. And if you just see the variation in smartphone pricing over the last 5 to 10 years, there's no reason why it actually could not have been here other than somebody taking the leadership position, setting up and getting assembly here. Once you get assembly here, then you get more of the supply base built up. Maybe some of it's in Mexico, some of it's in Canada. There's no reason it could have been done at a very like close price point.
The insight you provided to is like just so incredibly valuable. It's no wonder that innovation has been lacking so much. It's because we've brute forced essentially manufacturing by leveraging globalization. Because we had that $2 an hour rate in China or in Mexico or wherever else, yes. Like we're not like, well, we have to just get really good at building stuff to be competitive. I was like, nah, just let them do it. Like we'll get our margins. Just let them do it.
You're right. And it's the most under-discussed thing in the analyst world about Tesla. We talk about the new vehicles coming. Now we're starting to talk about autonomy. Finally, we're starting to have real discussions about autonomy. But what's the thing that's the most under-discussed thing is Tesla's next product is their new way of manufacturing. And it's a big deal. It is a big step in how products are made today. And I don't think anybody in a lot of these investments have the right research people actually looking into what the impact is and what it's going to enable. It's going to enable really the variable cost to build product. You have the bucket of parts and then you have the transformation of it. It's going to enable that transformation portion to shrink further and further and approach zero. It's that step function you need in cost reduction to get further scale. And I don't think enough people are, I think it's going to be the way the Cybercab is going to be made. It's going to be the way that Optimus is going to be made. I don't think enough people are talking about it. It's fine. Let them not talk about it, but it's a really big deal. Tesla versions their factories like they version their product. They spend time perfecting it and they have design reviews of their factory design like they have design reviews of their product. They have specs. They have performance attributes they're trying to meet. It's a very different, this doesn't happen at other companies at the executive level.
Wow. I mean, this is such a profound statement because a lot of the stories that I hear related to like, say, Tesla capitalizing on making manufacturing the product, like really just honing in so much on the factory that it becomes the product. The you know, and where we throw around 2 million cars per year, 5 million cars per year out of a factory, you know, tens of millions of bots per year, sooner than people think. You know, the usual narrative is crazy pie in the sky. They can't do that. Look at Ford, look at BYD. They can only, it's like, but what we're missing here is that we've had decades of just sitting on our asses, leveraging cheaper labor versus going out of our way to really push the boundaries of engineering and manufacturing.
Correct.
And now that we have a company that's willing to do that because the leader is viewing that as a first principles approach of manufacturing, right? Instead of like, it's like, okay, cheap labor is good, but why aren't we pushing manufacturing and engineering as much as we can to make this as efficient and as productive as possible? It's not like, I mean, of course, they're extremely talented. They're doing something very, very unique, but it's also on the backs of 30, 40 years of, I'm going to call it laziness. Like, you're just taking the easy way out. And I get it, more profits, you're taking care of shareholders. I get it. but you're not really pushing the boundaries of manufacturing. So,
well,
and I'll throw it to you, Hans. Sorry, let me just finish my thought here real quick. So I think what this leads to is we're going to have a massive, if companies and leaders truly take this to heart, we're going to see an explosion in manufacturing across the board. It's not just going to be a Tesla thing. I think we're going to see it all over the place.
Yeah. You're going to see the local, I'm advising companies on this now. You're going to see massive localization of manufacturing. And people think costs just instantly go up when you do that. They do, unmitigated. But if you're a company like Tesla and you're thinking about it the way they do, they're actually focused on localizing and making costs go down. Think of it. How many auto factories are expanding in Germany? Just answer that question. Go ahead, Hans. Sorry.
No, I was just that one.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a reason for that.
I think it goes back to areas of competence. Like there's only a handful of companies on Earth right now that are led by people who are competent engineering first leadership, that most of the rest of these companies are led by finance people, MBAs coming from an accounting background. You know, it's just like blatantly obvious that Apple under Jobs is a different company than Apple under Tim Cook. And the Tim Cooks of the world are the ones who run 90% of these big companies. And so they're focused on, you know, how do we maximize the efficiency or, you know, the profit making capability of the things that already exist. They're not trying to go out there and solve a new problem and then think, okay, what are the things that are in the way of between me and solving this big problem? And what are the things that I have to build in order to solve that big problem? They're just looking at what exists and how do I get the most out of it that I can possibly get today?
Yeah, it's thinking about like using the chess pieces or what you have in front of you versus inventing kind of an entire new game. And it's going to be exciting. It's going to be exciting to watch. It's actually happening right now in front of our eyes. People saw the Q3 results and are like, well, how's Tesla doing? Oh, it was this one-time thing or some battery supplier gave them a credit in the quarter. I'm reading this stuff on X. I'm like, did you see Tesla's accounts receivables? Like, are you reading purchase orders? How do you know this? It's absurd. No, there's things that they told you they got down to 28 seconds the total process time to do the Model Y in Shanghai from 43 seconds. You do the math. You've got a 28% improvement in manufacturing efficiency in that site, in the same site. So they're telling you what they're doing. You look at the 19 days of inventory in channel, and you look at the next, like the second best supply chain in auto is Toyota, and they're up at 35, 40 days, and that's in dealer inventory. And then you look at their balance sheet inventory. It was the same quarter on quarter, Q2 on Q3. This is the four-wall inventory inside of Tesla's factories, but they increased production by 15%. The only way you can increase production by 15% and maintain inventory is if you're bringing the stuff in and you're turning it faster. And that's what they're doing. And that created the cash surprise in Q3. It was supposed to be $1.6 billion of free cash, and they had $2.7 billion. Are there other things? But everybody wants to kind of point to, oh, there's ZEV credits. By the way, why is Tesla maximizing ZEV credits? Because other people can't make the vehicles profitably, and they're capitulating. So there's multiple stories to this to the side of this, but it's actually happening now. We don't have to even wait for the unbox model. People are like, how is Tesla at this gross margin? How are they doing this when the whole like industry is under this kind of stress? And the answers are kind of right in front of us. Finally, there's one thing that Tesla does that's kind of a hidden in cogs that a lot of people don't talk about. One of the VPs of supply chain actually brought it up on the earnings call. I've been bringing it up multiple times. Tesla has the most exciting portfolio in tech. So what do they do with their supply base? It's not wrong. It's not nefarious. It's win-win. They forward leverage their portfolio and say, all right, you're a supplier on the 3Y today. If you want a ticket to ride on Cybercab, which is going to be the volume of my entire portfolio today. So you're going to grow. I'm going to grow. If you want a ticket, I need help today on 3 and Y. I need you to stretch. I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And there's so many things under that strategy they can do. They can do a 2+1 model in sourcing. They can have a disruptor. There's all these things that Tesla can do because their aggregate volume is stable and or growing. And they have a history of meeting their volume targets and pulling the material from suppliers. So Tesla forward leverages their portfolio. It's a perfectly good thing to do. They've made successful suppliers that they've changed the lives of so many suppliers in the industry by just riding along with Tesla's growth. And so they're getting, so my point is they're getting COGS benefits today for, you know, banking on being a partner in that future execution in the future.
And so if we fast forward and we start factoring in the human or robot piece, the Tesla bot piece,
it's crazy.
It's only going to accelerate this by God knows how much, right?
It's crazy. Already,
it's crazy. Like it makes no sense, but it does.
Yeah. Well, that's why he has to have a conversation with CC Wei from TSMC about something that's 3 or 4 years in the future, because they're building fabs right now, and they're doing their multi-year planning in terms of fabs and where they're going to be located. And they want to have the conversation. They want to be aligned with the Elon Musk of the world. They want to be aligned with Tim Cooks of the world and so forth. It's really important to have that alignment.
So, Jeff, how closely do you follow RethinkX or some of the pieces that they've been putting out recently on humanoid robots?
I follow a little stuff that I'm seeing online. I spent a lot of time researching, honestly, a lot of the supply chain content out of Asia. I spent a lot of time reading that material. But yeah, go ahead. You got a question.
Yeah. So the reason that I ask is because Adam Dorr and Tony Seba and their research partner, Brad Libby, I think.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, they put forth a case basically saying we need to go into essentially a humanoid robot space race, and that the countries that will fund, like, let's just go ahead and do a massive public infrastructure build out campaign and be, you know, the first country to billions of humanoid robots, and that will have an incredible ROI as a nation. In that, you know, we need to do this ahead of, like, that whatever country does this first is going to have a massive competitive advantage compared to other countries. And so I'm curious, from your perspective, does it make sense to go ahead and try and do that sooner rather than later? And then, like, what's Tesla's place in that? In an environment where China's already, like, they have said that this is a massive national priority. They're already investing, you know, government funding into accelerating this industry, just like they did with automotive 10 years ago.
Yeah.
What should our response in the United States be, especially when we've got, you know, a leader like Tesla who we have at our disposal, but don't seem like we are thinking as clearly about the future as China is?
Yeah, there's three reasons you want to be thankful that how the election kind of went in Elon's proximity now to the White House. And one is as it relates to AI. And two, as it relates to how do you're going to navigate autonomy and regulatory with autonomy. And three, this conversion to humanoid labor. And then how do you handle that redistribution, you know, in your economy, and how do you deal with it? Because if you're a president, you're running for office, you obviously want to employ as many people as possible as one of kind of your things. So those three things are gigantic. I couldn't imagine these challenges being, you know, dealt with under a different election result. And you're right. China is married on public, on kind of these public priorities, and they do a very good job of figuring out how to get it funded, how to start early, and how they've owned the last, what was the last industry, you know, at least hardware wise, that was created and owned here? You have to really think back, even going back, we lost TVs, for example. We've lost smartphone. We've lost tablet. We've lost wearables. All this stuff has been lost over there. So we're going to have kind of a public-private bond here. And I think you're going to have it. You have some of the smartest minds, Silicon Valley and other parts of the country, now working with the future White House. And this is one of the things that needs to be figured out. I think manufacturing strategy needs to be figured out. I question the CHIPS Act, for example. I like the CHIPS Act. I like what it's about in terms of securing our supply. But the question is like nobody thought through the entire network and the entire supply network. Where do the chips go once they're made? The only place that they can go is if a data center is made here or a car. Everything else where most of these chips go, they're going to go back to Asia for assembly. So I think the other thing that's needed in government is somebody to kind of think through what's our localization strategy for manufacturing across multiple categories. You're right. China's figured this out in spades.
I think that was one of the epiphanies that I had recently, was just, you know, thinking about how pleased that I was about elements of the IRA and elements of the CHIPS Act.
Absolutely.
But when you really think about it, you realize, well, these were half measures. Like, they were only pleasing because they were a minor step up from absolute incompetence and stupidity. And so the fact that they weren't utterly catastrophic and useless, they were only mildly catastrophic and useless, was like, woohoo! Yeah. And then now we're, you know, in a place where we're actually going to be in a position to rethink some of these incredibly important things from first principles with the smartest people in the world in the room during that process.
Yeah. We need to localize supply. We need it for security. We need it for lowest cost. People worry, like, as we onshore these things, they're going to cost more to make because they think of the labor rate in Asia. But you have to think about transportation, logistics. You have to think about the whole thing. And then you have to think about a new way of manufacturing product here so that you can offset as much of that cost structure as possible. And we need it from a security perspective. We need it medical. Yeah. Like, you think about it across the board. So critical.
Yeah. Internalizing the cost of the national security implications of things is, you know, another huge, just what you were talking about earlier with assembly. Like, if you can just assemble all these things, like, think about the number of, you know, unit tests that you can implement to make sure that an electronic device is 100% secure when you're the one assembling literally every single component that goes into it, versus you send that out to some country somewhere else and you're not controlling that process. Like, the number of vulnerabilities that you introduce into your products and your supply chains at that level is, you know, it's just not even close to the same thing.
Yeah. And we have to create a gear that we don't have. We have not been schooling. We have not been putting the trade of, like, tooling development. Like, we flipped a lot of that off a couple of decades ago. We need to flip it back on. Tim Cook is famous for, like, hey, I can get a football field worth of tooling engineers rounded up in China within a day. And here, I don't think we can even create that. So there's things that we have to actually do that have faded away. As everybody wanted to develop software, and, you know, all these things, we've actually lost a lot of this capability. When we set up our manufacturing for smartphones in 2013, we were hiring labor for the factory. We realized a lot of the people did not have the fine motor skills to even deal with the size of parts we were dealing with. We were, holy shit, we missed something. We missed, like, just the human labor capability that's in Asia to do even manual assembly. And then we try to do some of the stuff. We're like, holy shit, we have to automate it because we just don't have people with that capability that can do those fine motors. It was fascinating. So yeah, there's a lot of things that we have to develop here to localize manufacturing, but it's a big thing from a security perspective.
We legitimately forgot how to make stuff. We just forgot how to make stuff straight up.
Yes.
I think what's fascinating about this time, though, is that it's not just a vision. I think the right people seem to be coalescing to actually execute and make this a reality, which I think it feels like it's an explosion. It's a positive explosion for America. Like, it's because we're starting from below zero. we're starting at a point where we don't even have the right people trained to do this kind of stuff. And so any sort of material improvement is going to feel like night and day. And that's what gets me so excited about, like, really the near future, because we should see a lot of those things by the end of the decade start to, like, manifest. And I think Tesla will be one of the companies that drives that forward. But I think that's what has me so excited about this time. It's like it legitimately feels like something big will go down because we actually have people in place to get that stuff done, and they're all aligned on the vision. That's the vibe I get anyway.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we have to own humanoid. We have to own other form factors of AI edge devices. Like, those two categories, we cannot let go. I mean, China's going to figure out, and they're going to build this stuff. There's no question about it. We just can't be, you know, we can't succumb to that, like, where we have to get it from them. Like, we have to be able to figure out how to localize this stuff, build it at cost, figure out how to localize supply and get this thing ramped at the velocity and the cost structure that we, and the capability that we need. We cannot lose more generations of product over there. Cause once these AI edge devices start, they're going to hit medical, they're going to hit consumer, they're going to hit everything and humanoids. I mean, we can't allow this stuff to just be, you know, where we're customers of it and we have to buy it from everywhere else in the world versus making it here.
It's a legitimate national security risk. Like, yes. A legitimate national security risk.
Yeah. And for people who don't have a concrete example in their mind when we say this, right now, United States police officers and military members commonly have DJI drones in their backpacks. Every single one of those DJI drones are manufactured in China. They have unknown hardware and software vulnerabilities. There is a potential that each and every one of those things could be used at minimum as a surveillance device against our police and our military, or at maximum, those things could be weapons that are turned on our civil servants en masse. And the reason that is the case is because we have just, declared surrender in the drone manufacturing industry to China, because we were not interested in creating the type of regulatory environment here in the United States where, like, we specifically and intentionally kneecapped our own homegrown drone industry, and we put restrictions on them that the Chinese companies are not subject to. And because the Chinese companies are not subject to those, they're able to outcompete us. They're a lot like DJI is allowed to make drones that US companies are not allowed to make. And because of that, they have the best drones and everyone uses them. DJI has, like, what, 90% market share of consumer drones, something like that. And, like, this is one example of an area that, like, this pattern repeats itself across multiple industries, across multiple national security critical areas and technologies.
We've been led by buffoons. That's the vibe I get. There's a bunch of buffoons just in our government. Just, they have no idea what the fuck is happening.
It's such a good example, Hans. It's I talked about the future industries that we need to own and make sure it's here, but I would say the drone side, that's one where we need to architect a U-turn, and we do need to figure out design and manufacturing of it here, and in next generation version. Like, we have to figure that out.
And let me give you one more question here, Jeff, before we let you go. I know you're a very busy man, so I want to be very respectful of your time.
Everyone's busy, yeah.
the the humanoid robot TAM, right? So walk me through how you're viewing this playing out long term. Is this a like one player wins most? Is this the TAM is so big that there's going to be a lot of players? What are the variables that sort of play into that? Let's pull on that thread for a bit.
I think you're not going to have to worry about, like, being crowded from a market share perspective, because I think the TAM is going to be even bigger than smartphone. Smartphone today is about 1.2 billion units, new units per year, and there's about 4.5 billion in circulation, maybe closer to 5 billion. It's hard to get accurate numbers on it. But I think humanoid can be bigger. There's going to be room for many. There's also going to be, I think, a lot of licensing involved, because I think the brain and the actuator development and manufacturing are going to need, are going to be the secret sauce that need to be licensed. And so some may not get there, and they may, and this could be another licensing opportunity again for Tesla. Because some are going to get to the start, some are going to get to the finish line and be like, holy shit. Like, I'm not going to name the name of a company, but oh my God, I have to buy chips from NVIDIA for inference. I have to buy OpenAI is doing my inference software. I got to pay them a margin. I had to pay NVIDIA a margin. This CM is doing my manufacturing, or I got to pay. And all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, my time to break even on this thing is like infinity. And so you're going to have some of them get to the finish line with a pretty good product, then they run into an economics problem. You're going to have some that get there from a hardware perspective and don't have the brain. But I think there's going to be multiple players. I just think when I envision that row of like Jensen standing on stage, and there were nine or so, I don't think Optimus was there, by the way. I think maybe one of those gets to the finish line, you know, maybe two, but eventually over time, there'll be versions of it that get to the finish line. So huge TAM. There will be multiple players, but I think there's going to be a monopoly on the brain and the actuators for the fine motor skills.
Yeah, that's helpful to think through. I think the one thing that I have a hard time letting go of is, and you tell me if this is like a stupid way of thinking about this, the player that has a manufacturing expertise to build these will have an advantage that will compound on itself, similar to the player that has the most compute for AI, and they know how to make that flywheel to get better faster than everyone else.
Yes,
will win everything, right?
Yes.
So because once you figure out how to build the robot really well, the robot's going to help you build the robot really well, and then that compounds, right? So, and there's really only one player that I can think of in Tesla that has that. So is that a stupid way for me to think about this, that long term, the one that knows how to build the robots fastest and knows how to use the robots best wins everything?
We could spend an afternoon talking about something that's never talked about, which is, how do you implement AI in manufacturing? Real AI, not machine learning, how do you anticipate defects before they happen? How do you tie the mechanical assembly of a photon representation of the mechanical assembly to the device, how it's actually going to perform in functional tests, and how do you start driving those correlations? There's so much work that can be done with AI manufacturing. And then eventually it is coming down to, and there are companies, even NVIDIA talks about factory design, which is like, how do you actually balance the line in the factory so you get optimum flow through each cell of the station? So yeah, it's nutty. It's nutty kind of where this goes. You think about what Tesla is doing on the outside with AI. Like, I think they have the most compelling AI, like shipping AI solution out there that actually solves real world problems for you. Now imagine if they're doing that on the outside for consumers, what are they doing on the inside of their factories to enable AI? If you imagine how enveloped Elon is with AI, imagine how he's challenging his directs to figure out part design, to figure out manufacturing flow, and like, how do you implement AI in those elements as well to get better, to use less labor involved, to even do product and factory development? It'll blow your mind. We can talk all afternoon.
What the hell? Okay, so I guess you're going to have to come back.
Yeah, we could.
Go ahead,
Hunter. Yeah, and remember that the entire FSD external product grew up out of, I can't remember what the name of the project was. I think it's Bamboo Road, maybe, but all the automated unit testing that Tesla does of their cars, they want to be able to test every single car. And so they wanted the car to be able to drive itself through all of the unit tests and do that autonomously. And that project is what led to FSD as a product that we as consumers now get to enjoy. So that was already the birthplace of one of the most important external facing AI products. And as Jeff said, it makes you wonder what is going on inside the factory today, especially when you know that Tesla rolls all their own software. You know, their entire ERP system is homegrown and They have incredible software talent in space.
Very, very under discussed.
Insane. Jeff, where can people find you, man?
I'm hanging out on X at the Jeff Lutz. I think it's up there. And yeah, it's great speaking with you and Hans. And I love following the, you know, what you guys do. You talk about really important things. And I just think there's a lot going on, like in with Tesla, with Optimus, with, you know, everything in these companies. And it's just, it's fun to talk about it. It's fun to kind of apply like learned skills and like what it may mean to what's happening. I don't know. I'm not smarter than Tesla. I don't claim to be, but it's interesting to kind of like, I kind of can view things with maybe a different lens at times.
Yeah. Make sure you go check him out at the Jeff Lutz on X. He also is a contributor on Brighter with Herbert as well. Make sure you check Herbert out and his awesome channel. Yeah, I feel like for me, V13 is such a gigantic catalyst because it opens the door to everything. Everything opens from the advent of a neural end-to-end neural network being able to just leverage cameras to operate with the real world just as good, if not better, than a human. Everything opens up from that point, you know? So anyway, all right, we're gonna have to have you back, Jeff.
I can't believe
we waited this freaking long to have you here. So
good stuff.
Thank you so much for coming.
Have a good afternoon. See you guys. Yeah. Take care. Bye.
And recording here.